This audio program is brought to you courtesy of Audible.com. Audible, audio that speaks to you wherever you are.
Fourth Protocol by Frederick Forsyth, read by David Rintoul. Part 1. Chapter 1. The man in grey decided to take the Glen suite of diamonds at midnight, provided they were still in the apartment safe and the occupants away. This he needed to know, so he watched. And he waited. At 7:30 he was rewarded. The big, wide limousine swooped up from the subterranean car park with a powerful grace implied by its name. It paused for an instant in the mouth of the cavern as its driver checked the street for traffic, then turned into the road and headed towards Hyde Park Corner. Sitting across from the luxury apartment block, dressed in a hired chauffeur's uniform at the wheel of the rented Volvo estate, Jim Rawlings breathed a sigh of relief. Gazing unobserved across the Belgravia street, he had seen what he had hoped for. The husband had been at the wheel with his wife beside him. He already had the engine running and the heater on to keep out the cold. Moving the automatic shift into drive, he eased out of the line of parked cars and went after the Daimler Jaguar. It was a crisp and bright morning, with a pale wash of light over Green Park in the east and the street lights still on. Rawlings had been at the stakeout since 5 o'clock, and although a few people had passed down the street, no one had taken any notice of him. A chauffeur in a big car in Belgravia, richest of London's West End districts, attracts no attention, least of all with 4 suitcases and a hamper in the back, on the morning of 31st December. Many of the rich would be preparing to leave the capital to celebrate the festivities at their country homes. He was 50 yards behind the Jaguar at Hyde Park Corner, allowing a truck to move between them. Up Park Lane, Rawlings had one momentary misgiving. There was a branch of Coutts Bank there, and he feared the couple in the Jaguar might pause to drop the diamonds into the night safe. At Marble Arch he breathed a second sigh of relief. The limousine ahead of him made no turn around the arch to take the southbound carriageway back down Park Lane towards the bank. It sped straight up Great Cumberland Place, joined Gloucester Place, and kept on north. So the occupants of the luxury apartment on the 8th floor of Fontenoy House were not leaving the items with Coutts. Either they had them in the car and were taking them to the country, or they were leaving them for the New Year period in the apartment. Rawlings was confident it would be the latter. He tailed the Jaguar to Hendon, watched it speeding into the last mile before the M1 motorway, and then turned back towards central London. Evidently, as he had hoped, they were going to join the wife's brother, the Duke of Sheffield, at his estates in North Yorkshire, a full 6-hour drive away. That would give him a minimum of 24 hours, more than he needed. He had no doubts he could take the apartment at Fontenoy House. He was, after all, one of the best cracksmen in London. By mid-morning, he had returned the Volvo to the rental company, the uniform to the costumiers, and the empty suitcases to the cupboard. He was back in his top-floor flat, a comfortable and expensively furnished pad atop a converted tea warehouse in his native Wandsworth. However he prospered, he was a South Londoner, born and bred, and though Wandsworth might not be as chic as Belgravia or Mayfair, it was his manor. Like all of his kind, he hated to leave the security of his own manor. Within it he felt reasonably safe, even though to the local underworld and the police he was known as a face, underworld slang for a criminal or villain. Like all successful villains, he kept a low profile around the manor, driving an unobtrusive car, his sole indulgence being the elegance of his apartment. He cultivated a deliberate vagueness among the lower orders of the underworld as to exactly what he did, and although the police accurately suspected his speciality, his form book was clean, apart from a short stretch of porridge as a teenager. His evident success, and the vagueness about how he achieved it, evoked reverence among the young aspirants in the game, who were happy to perform small errands for him. Even the heavy mobs who took out wage offices in broad daylight with shotguns and pickaxe handles left him alone. As was necessary, he had to have a front occupation to account for the money. All the successful faces had some form of legitimate business. The favoured ones have always been minicab driving, or owning greengrocer shops, or a scrap metal and general dealership. All these fronts permit a lot of hidden profits, cash dealing, spare time, a range of hiding places, and the facility to employ a couple of heavies, or slags. These are hard men of little brain but considerable strength, who also need an apparently legitimate employment to supplement their habitual profession as muscle hire. Rawlings, in fact, had a scrap metal dealership and a car wrecking yard. It gave him access to a well-equipped machine workshop, metal of all kinds, electrical wiring, battery acid, and the two big thugs he employed both in the yard and as backup should he ever run into any aggro from villains who might decide to make trouble for him. Showered and shaved, Rawlings stirred Demerara crystals into his second espresso of the morning and studied again the sketch drawings Billy Rice had left him. Billy was his apprentice, a smart 23-year-old who would one day become good, even very good. He was still starting out on the fringe of the underworld and eager to do favours for a man of prestige, apart from the invaluable instructions he would get in the process. 24 hours earlier, Billy had knocked at the door of the 8th-floor apartment at Fontenoy House, dressed in the livery of an expensive flower shop and carrying a large bouquet of flowers. The props had got him effortlessly past the commissionaire in the lobby, where he had also noted the exact layout of the entrance hall, the porter's lodge, and the way to the stairs. It was her ladyship who had answered the door personally, her face lighting up with surprise and pleasure at the sight of the flowers. They purported to come from the Committee of the Distressed Veterans Benevolent Fund, of which Lady Fiona was one of the patronesses, and whose gala ball she was due to attend that very night, 30th of December, 1986. Rawlings figured that even if, at the ball itself, she mentioned the bouquet to any one of the committee members, he would simply assume it had been sent by another member on behalf of them all. At the door, she had examined the attached card, exclaimed, "Oh, how perfectly lovely!" in the bright, cut crystal accents of her class, and taken the bouquet. Then Billy had held out his receipt pad and ballpoint pen. Unable to manage all three items together, Lady Fiona had withdrawn, flustered, into the sitting room to put down the bouquet, leaving Billy unattended for several seconds in the small hallway. With his boyish looks, fluffy blonde hair, blue eyes, and shy smile, Billy was a gift. He reckoned he could work his way past any middle-aged housewife in the metropolis, but his baby blue eyes missed very little. Before even pressing the doorbell, he had spent a full minute scanning the outside of the door, its frame and surrounding wall area and the passage. He was looking for a small buzzer, no larger than a walnut or a black button or switch with which to turn the buzzer off. Only when satisfied there was none did he ring the bell. Left alone in the doorway, he did the same again, searching the inner side of the frame and the walls for buzzer or switch. Again, there was none. By the time the lady of the house returned to the hall to sign the receipt, Billy knew the door was secured by a shunt lock, which he had gratefully identified as a Chubb rather than a Brahma, which is reputedly unpickable. Lady Fiona took the pad and pen and tried to sign for the flowers. No chance. The ballpoint pen had long had its cartridge removed and any remaining ink expended on a blank piece of paper. Billy apologized profusely. With a bright smile, Lady Fiona told him it was of no account. She was sure she had one in her bag and returned beyond the sitting-room door. Billy had already noted what he sought. The door was indeed linked to an alarm system. Protruding from the edge of the open door, high up on the hinge side, was a small plunger contact. Opposite it, set in the door jamb, was a tiny socket. Inside that socket, he knew, would be a Pi microswitch. With the door in the closed position, the plunger would enter the socket and make a contact. With the burglar alarm set and activated, the microswitch would trigger the alarm if the contact were broken, that is, if the door were opened. It took Billy less than 3 seconds to bring out his tube of superglue, squirt a hefty dollop into the orifice containing the microswitch, and tamp the whole thing down with a small ball of plasticine and glue compound. In 4 seconds more, it was rock hard, and the microswitch blanked off from the entering plunger in the edge of the door. When Lady Fiona returned with the signed receipt, she found the nice young man leaning against the door jamb, from which he straightened up with an apologetic smile, smearing any surplus from the ball of his thumb as he did so. Later, Billy had given Jim Rawlings a complete description of the layout of the entrance, porter's lodge, location of the stairs and elevators, the passage to the apartment door, the small hallway behind the door, and what part of the sitting room he'd been able to see. As he sipped his coffee, Rawlings was confident that 4 hours earlier, the apartment owner had carried his suitcases into the corridor and returned to his own hallway to set his alarm. As usual, it had made no sound. Closing the front door after him, he would have turned the key fully in the mortise lock, satisfied his alarm was now set and activated. Normally, the plunger would have been in contact with the Pi microswitch. The turning of the key would have established the complete link, activating the whole system. But with the plunger blanked off from the microswitch, the door system at least would be inert. Rawlings was certain he could take that door lock inside 30 minutes. In the apartment itself, there would be other traps. He would cope with those when he met them. Finishing his coffee, he reached for his file of newspaper cuttings. Like all jewel thieves, Rawlings followed the society gossip columns closely. This particular file was entirely about the social appearances of Lady Fiona, and the suite of perfect diamonds she had worn to the gala ball the previous evening, so far as Jim Rawlings was concerned, for the last time. 1,000 miles to the east, the old man standing at the window of the sitting room in the third-floor front apartment at Prospekt Mira 111 was also thinking of midnight. It would herald the 1st of January 1987, his 75th birthday. The hour was well past midday, but he was still in a robe. There was little enough cause these days to rise early or spruce up to go to the office. There was no office to go to. His Russian wife, Erita, 30 years his junior, had taken their two boys skating along the flooded and frozen lanes of Gorky Park, so he was alone. He caught a glance of himself in a wall mirror, and the prospect brought him no more joy than to contemplate his life, or what was left of it. The face, always lined, was now deeply furrowed. The hair, once thick and dark, was now snow-white, skimpy and lifeless. The skin, after a lifetime of titanic drinking and chain-smoking, was blotched and mottled. The eyes gazed back miserably. He returned to the window and looked down at the snow-choked street. A few muffled, huddled babushkas were sweeping away the snow, which would fall again tonight. It had been so long, he mused, 24 years almost to the day, since he had quit his non-job and pointless exile in Beirut to come here. There had been no point in staying. Nick Elliott and the rest of the firm had got it all together by then. He had finally admitted it to them himself. So he had come, leaving wife and children to join him later if they wished. At first he thought it was like coming home to a spiritual and moral home. He had thrown himself into the new life. He had truly believed in the philosophy and its eventual triumph. Why not? He had spent 27 years serving it. He had been happy and fulfilled those first early years of the mid-60s. There had been the extensive debriefing, of course, but he had been revered within the Committee of State Security. He was, after all, one of the 5 stars, the greatest of them all, with Burgess, Maclean, Blunt and Blake, the ones who had burrowed into the inner core of the British establishment and betrayed it all. Burgess, drinking and buggering his way to an early grave, had been in it before he had arrived. Maclean had lost his illusions first, but then he had been in Moscow since 1951. By 1963 he was sour and embittered, taking it out on Melinda, who had finally quit to come here, to this apartment. Maclean had gone on, somehow, utterly disillusioned and resentful, until the cancer got him, by which time he hated his hosts, and they hated him. Blunt had been blown and disgraced back in England. That left him and Blake, the old man thought. In a way he envied Blake, completely assimilated, utterly content, who had invited him and Erita round for New Year's Eve. Of course, Blake had had a cosmopolitan background, Dutch father, Jewish mother. For him personally, there could be no assimilation. He had known that after the first 5 years. By then, he had learned fluent Russian, written and spoken, but he still retained a remarkable English accent. Apart from that, he had come to hate the society. It was a completely irreversible and unalterably alien society. That was not the worst of it. Within 7 years of arriving, he had lost his last political illusions. It was all a lie, and he had been smart enough to see through it. He had spent his youth and manhood serving a lie, lying for the lie, betraying for the lie, abandoning that green and pleasant land, and all for a lie. For years, provided as of right with every British magazine and newspaper, he had followed the cricket scores while advising on the inspiration of strikes, looked at the old familiar places in the magazines while preparing disinformation aimed at bringing it all to ruin, perched unobserved on a barstool in the National to listen to the Brits laughing and joking in his language while counseling the top men of the KGB, including even the chairman himself, on how best to subvert that little island. And all the time, deep inside these past 15 years, there had been a great void of despair that not even the drink and the many women had been able to blank out. It was too late. He could never go back, he told himself. And yet... The doorbell rang. It puzzled him. Prospekt Mira 111 is a totally KGB-owned block in a quiet back street of central Moscow, with mainly senior KGB tenants and a few foreign ministry people. A visitor would have to check in with the concierge. It could not be Erita. She had her own key. When he opened the door, a man stood there alone. He was youthful and looked fit, sheathed in a well-cut greatcoat and with a warm fur shapka, without insignia, on his head. His face was coldly impassive, but not from the freezing wind outside, for his shoes indicated he had stepped from a warm car into a warm apartment block, not trudged through icy snow. Blank blue eyes stared at the old man with neither friendship nor hostility. "Comrade Colonel Philby?" he asked. Philby was surprised. Close personal friends, the Blakes and half a dozen others, called him Kim. For the rest, he had lived under a pseudonym for many, many years. Only to a few at the very top was he Philby, a full KGB colonel on the retired list.
"Yes?"
"I am Major Pavlov, of the 9th Directorate, attached to the personal staff of the General Secretary of the CPSU. Philby knew the 9th Directorate of the KGB. It provided the bodyguards for all the top party personnel and the buildings in which they worked and lived. In uniform, nowadays confined to inside the party buildings and for ceremonial occasions, they would wear the distinctive electric blue cap bands, shoulder boards and lapel tabs, and be also known as the Kremlin Guards. Attached as personal bodyguards, they would wear beautifully cut civilian clothes. They would also be utterly fit, highly trained, icily loyal, and armed."
"Indeed," said Philby.
"This is for you, Comrade Colonel." The Major held out a long envelope of high-quality paper. Philby took it. "This also," said Major Pavlov, and held out a small square of pasteboard with a phone number on it.
"Thank you,"
said Philby. Without a further word, the Major inclined his head briefly, turned on his heel, and went back down the corridor. Seconds later, from his window, Philby watched the sleek black Chaika limousine with its distinctive Central Committee number plates, beginning with the letters M.O.C., slide away from the front entrance. Jim Rawlings peered down at the Society magazine photograph through a magnifying glass. The picture showed the woman he had seen driving north out of London that morning with her husband, albeit taken a year earlier. She was standing in a presentation line while the woman next to her greeted Princess Alexandra, and she was wearing the stones. Rawlings, who studied for months before he made a hit, knew their provenance better than his own birth date. In 1905, the young Earl of Margate had returned from South Africa, bearing with him 4 magnificent but uncut stones. On his marriage in 1912, he had had Cartier of London cut and set the stones as a present to his young wife. Cartier had them cut by Aschers of Amsterdam, still then regarded as the finest cutters in the world, following their triumph in the cutting of the massive Cullinan stone. The 4 original gems emerged as 2 matching pairs of pear-shaped 58-facet stones, one pair weighing in at 10 carats each, the other pair at 20 carats each. Back in London, Cartier had set these stones in white gold, surrounded by a total of 40 much smaller stones, to create a suite composed of a tiara with, as its centrepiece, one of the larger of the pear-shaped gems, a pendant with the other as its centrepiece, and 2 matching pendant earrings with the 2 smaller stones. Before they were ready, the Earl's father, the 7th Duke of Sheffield, died, and the Earl succeeded to the title. The diamonds became known as the Glen Diamonds, after the family name of the House of Sheffield. The 8th Duke had passed them on his death in 1936 to his son, and he in turn had had 2 children, a daughter born in 1944 and a son born in 1949. It was this daughter, now aged 42,
whose image was beneath Jim Rawlings' magnifying glass. "You won't be wearing them again, darling," said Rawlings to himself. Then he began checking once again his equipment for the evening. Harold Filby slit the envelope with a kitchen knife, extracted the letter, and spread it on the sitting room table. He was impressed. It was from the General Secretary of the CPSU personally, handwritten in the Soviet leader's neat, clerkish script, and, of course, in Russian. The paper was of fine quality, like the matching envelope, and unheaded. He must have written it from his personal apartment in No. 26 Kutuzovsky Prospect, the huge block which, since the time of Stalin, had contained in its sumptuous quarters the Moscow homes of the very top level of the party hierarchs. In the top right-hand corner were the words, A.M., Wednesday, 31st December, 1986. The text came below. It read, "Dear Filby, my attention has been drawn to a remark made by you at a recent dinner party in Moscow, to wit, that the political stability of Great Britain is constantly overestimated here in Moscow, and never more so than at the present time. I would be happy to receive from you an expansion and clarification of this remark. Put this explanation in written form, and direct it to me personally, without retaining any copies or using secretaries. When it is ready, call the number Major Pavlov has given you, ask to speak to him personally, and he will come to your residence to collect it. My felicitations upon your birthday tomorrow. Sincerely." The letter ended with his signature. Filby let out his breath slowly. So, Kryuchkov's dinner on the 26th for senior officers of the KGB had been bugged after all. He had half suspected it. As first deputy chairman of the KGB and head of its first chief directorate, Vladimir Alexandrovich Kryuchkov was the general secretary's creature, body and soul. Although styled a colonel general, Kryuchkov was no military man, nor even a professional intelligence officer. He was a party apparatchik to his bootstraps, one of those brought in by the present Soviet leader when he had been chairman of the KGB. Filby read the letter again, then pushed it away from him. The old man's style hadn't changed, he thought, brief to the point of starkness, clear and concise, devoid of elaborate courtesies, inviting no contradiction. Even the reference to Philby's birthday was brief enough simply to show he had called for the file and little more. Still, Filby was impressed. A personal letter from this most glacial and remote of men was unusual, and would have had many men trembling at the honour. Years ago it had been different. When the present Soviet leader had arrived at the KGB as chairman, Filby had already been there for years and was considered something of a star. He lectured on the Western intelligence agencies in general and on the British SIS in particular. Like all incoming party men set to command professionals of another discipline, the new chairman had looked to put his own placemen in key posts. Filby, even though respected and admired as one of the five stars, realized that a patron in very high places would be useful in this most conspiratorial of societies. The chairman, a highly intelligent and cultured man, had shown a curiosity, short of fascination, but above mere interest, in Britain. Many times over those years he had asked Filby for an interpretation or analysis of events in Britain, its personalities and likely reactions, and Filby had been happy to oblige. It was as if the KGB chairman wanted to check what reached his desk from the in-house Britain experts and from those at his old office, the International Department of the Central Committee under Boris Ponomariev, against other critique. Several times he had heeded Philby's quiet advice on matters pertaining to Britain. It had been some time since Filby had seen the new Tsar of all the Russias face to face. That was when he had attended a reception to mark the chairman's departure from the KGB back to the Central Committee, apparently as a secretary, in fact, to prepare for his predecessor's coming death and to mastermind his own advancement. And now he was seeking Philby's interpretation again. His reverie was interrupted by the return of Erita and the boys, flushed from skating and noisy as ever. Back in 1975, long after Melinda McLean's departure, when the higher-ups of the KGB had decided his desultory whoring and drinking had lost their charms, for the apparat at least, Erita had been ordered to move in with him. She was a KGB girl then, unusually also Jewish, aged 34, dark and solid. They had married the same year. After the marriage, his notable personal charm had taken its toll. She had genuinely fallen in love with him, and had roundly refused to report on him any more to the KGB. The case officer had shrugged, reported back, and been told to drop the matter. The boys had come 2 and 3 years later. "Anything important, Kim?" she asked, as he stood and pushed the letter into his pocket. He shook his head. She went on pulling the thick quilted jackets off the boys. "Nothing, my love," he said. But she could see he was absorbed by something. She knew better than to insist, but she came over and kissed him on the cheek. "Please don't drink too much at the Blakes tonight." "I'll try," he said with a smile. In fact, he was going to permit himself one last bender. A lifelong toper, who, when he started drinking at a party, would usually go on till he collapsed, he had ignored 100 doctors' warnings to quit. They had forced him to stop the cigarettes, and that had been bad enough, but not the booze. He could still quit it when he wanted, and he knew that he would have to stop for a while after this evening's party. He recalled the remark he had made at Kryuchkov's dinner table, and the thoughts that had prompted it. He knew what was going on, and what was intended, deep inside the heart of Britain's Labour Party. Others had received the mass of raw intelligence that he had studied over the years, and which was still passed to him as a sort of favour. But only he had been able to put all the pieces together, assembling them within the framework of British mass psychology, to come up with a real picture. If he was going to do justice to the idea forming in his mind, he was going to have to describe that picture in words, prepare for the Soviet leader one of the best pieces he had ever penned. At the weekend he could send Erita and the boys to the Dacha. He would start, alone in the apartment, at the weekend. Before then, one last bender. Jim Rawlings spent the hour between 9 and 10 that night sitting in another, smaller, rented car outside Fontenoy House. He was dressed in a beautifully cut dinner jacket and attracted no attention. What he was studying was the pattern of lights high up in the apartment block. The flat he had targeted was, of course, in darkness, but he was happy to see that lights were on in the apartments above and below it. In each, to judge from the appearances of guests at the windows, New Year parties were getting under way. At 10, with his car parked discreetly in a side street 2 blocks away, he sauntered into the front entrance of Fontenoy House. There had been so many people going in and out that the doors were closed, but not locked. Inside the lobby, on the left-hand side, was the porter's lodge, just as Billy Rice had said. Inside it, the night porter was watching his Japanese portable. He rose and came to his doorway as if to speak. Rawlings was carrying a bottle of champagne decorated with a huge ribbon bow. He waved a hand in tipsy greeting. "Evening!" he called, and added, "Oh, Happy New Year!" If the old porter was thinking of asking for identification or destination, he thought better of it. There were at least 6 parties going on in the block. Half of them seemed to be open house, so how was he to check guest lists?
Thank you, sir. Happy New Year, sir,"
he called, but the dinner-jacketed back had gone down the corridor. He returned to his movie. Rawlings used the stairs to the first floor, then the lift to the 8th. At 10:05, he was outside the door of the apartment he sought. As Billy had reported, there was no buzzer, and the lock was a Chubb mortise. There was a secondary, self-closing Yale lock 20 inches above the Chubb for everyday use. The Chubb mortise has a total of 17,000 computations and permutations. It is a 5-lever lock, but for a good keyman, not an insuperable problem, since only the first 2.5 levers need to be ascertained. The other 2.5 are the same, but in reverse, so that the owner's key will operate equally well when introduced from the other side of the door. After leaving school at 16, Rawlings had spent 10 years working with and under his Uncle Albert in the latter's hardware shop. It was a good front for the old man, himself a notable cracksman in his day. It gave the eager young Rawlings access to every known lock on the market and most of the smaller safes. After 10 years of endless practice and with Uncle Albert's expert coaching, Rawlings could take just about any lock in manufacture. From his trouser pocket, he produced a ring of 12 skeleton keys, all made up in his own workshop. He selected and tested 3, one after the other, and settled for the 6th on the ring. Inserting it into the chub, he began to detect the pressure points inside the lock. Then, using a flat pack of slim steel files from his top pocket, he started to work on the softer metal of the skeleton. Within 10 minutes, he had the first 2.5 levers, the configuration or profile that he needed. In another 15 minutes, he had reproduced the same 2.5 lever pattern in reverse. Inserting the finished skeleton into the chub lock, he turned it slowly and carefully. It went fully back. He waited for 60 seconds, just in case Billy's tamp of plasticine and superglue compound had not held inside the door jamb. No bells. He let out a sigh and went to work on the Yale with a fine steel spike. That took 60 seconds, and the door swung quietly open. It was dark inside, but the light from the corridor gave him the outlines of the empty hallway. It was about 8 feet square and carpeted. He suspected there would be a pressure pad somewhere, but not too close to the door, lest the owner should trigger it himself. Stepping into the hall, close to the wall, he eased the door closed behind him and put on the hall light. To his left was a door, partly open, through which he could see a lavatory. To his right, another door, almost certainly the cloak's cupboard, containing the alarm control system, which he would leave alone. Taking a pair of pliers from his breast pocket, he stooped and lifted the carpet from its smooth edge beading. As the square of carpet rose, he spotted the pressure pad in the dead center of the hall, just the one. Letting the carpet gently back in place, he stepped around it and opened the large door ahead of him. As Billy had said, it was the door to the sitting room. He stood for several minutes on the threshold of the sitting room before identifying the light switch and putting on the lights. It was a risk, but he was 8 floors above the street. The owners were in Yorkshire, and he did not have the time to work in a booby-trapped room by pencil torch. The room was oblong, about 25 feet by 18, carpeted and richly furnished. Ahead of him were the double-glazed picture windows facing south and over the street. To his right was a wall containing a stone fireplace and gas log fire, with in one corner a door presumably leading to the master bedroom suite. To his left, the opposite wall contained 2 doors. One opened to the passage leading to the guest bedrooms, the other closed, perhaps to the dining room and kitchen. He spent another 10 minutes, standing motionless, scanning the walls and ceiling. His reason was simple. There could well be a static movement alarm that Billy Rice had not seen, but which would detect any body heat or movement entering the room. If bells went off, he could be out of there in 3 seconds. There were no bells. The system was based on a wired-up door, probably windows, which he did not intend to touch anyway, and a system of pressure pads. The safe, he was sure, would be in this room or the master bedroom, and it would be on an outside wall, since interior walls would not be thick enough. He spotted it just before 11 o'clock. Right in front of him, in an 8-foot piece of wall, between the 2 wide windows, was a gilt-framed mirror, not hanging slightly away from the wall like the pictures, casting a narrow shadow at the edge, but too flat to the wall, as if hinged. Using his pliers to lift the edge of the carpet, he worked his way around the walls, unveiling the thread-like wires leading from the skirting board to the pads, somewhere out towards the center of the room. When he reached the mirror, he saw there was one pressure pad directly beneath it. He thought of moving it, but instead lifted a large, low coffee table from nearby and placed it over the pad, its legs clear of the edges. He now knew that if he stayed close to the walls or stood on pieces of furniture, no furniture can stand on a pressure pad, he would be safe. The mirror was kept close to the wall by a magnetic catch, also wired up. That was no problem. He slipped a flat wafer of magnetized steel between the 2 magnets of the catch, one in the mirror frame and the other in the wall. Keeping his substitute flat to the wall-based magnet, he eased the mirror away from the wall. The wall magnet made no protest. It was still in contact with another magnet, so it did not report that any contact had been broken. Rawlings smiled. The wall safe was a nice little Hamber, Model D. He knew the door was made of 1/2-inch thick, high-tensile, hardened steel, The hinge was a vertical rod of hardened steel going into the frame upwards and downwards from the door itself. The securing mechanism consisted of three hardened steel bolts emerging from the door and entering the frame to a depth of 1.5 inches. Behind the steel face of the door was a 2-inch-deep tinplate box containing the three locking bolts, the vertical control bolt that governed their movements, and the three-wheel combination lock, whose face was now staring at him. Rawlings did not intend to tamper with any of this. There was an easier way. To cut the door from top to bottom just on the hinge side of the combination dial. That would leave 60% of the door, containing the combination lock and three locking bolts, jammed into the safe's door frame. The other 40% of the door would swing open, giving him enough space to get his hand inside and the contents out. He worked his way back to the hall, where he had left his bottle of champagne, and returned with it. Squatting on the coffee table, he unscrewed the bottom of the false bottle and emptied out his supplies. Apart from an electric detonator, ensconced in cotton wool in a small box, a collection of small magnets and a reel of ordinary household 5-amp flex, he had brought a length of CLC. Rawlings knew the best way to cut 1/2-inch steel plate was to use the Monroe theory, named after the inventor of the shaped charge principle. What he was holding was called in the trade charge linear cutting, or CLC, a V-shaped length of metal, stiff but just pliable, encased in plastic explosive. It was manufactured by three companies in Britain, one government-owned and the other two in the private sector. CLC was definitely not available except under stringent license, but as a professional cracksman, Rawlings had a contact, a bent employee in one of the private sector companies. Quickly and expertly, Rawlings prepared the length he needed and applied it to the outside of the Hambers door from top to bottom, just one side of the combination dial. Into one end of the CLC, he inserted the detonator, from which protruded two twisted copper wires. These he untwisted and separated widely to prevent a short circuit later. To each wire, he attached one of the strands from his domestic flex, which was itself terminated in a 3-pin domestic plug. Unravelling this carefully, he worked his way backwards round the room and into the corridor leading to the guest bedrooms. The lee of the passage would give him protection from the blast. Making his way gingerly to the kitchen, he filled with water a large polythene bag from his pocket. This he fixed to the wall with thumbtacks to hang over the explosive on the safe's door. Feather cushions, Uncle Albert had told him, are for the birds and TV. There is no shock absorber like water. It was 20 to midnight. Above him, the party was getting noisier and noisier. Even in this luxury block, with its accent on privacy, he could clearly hear the shouting and dancing. His last act before retiring to the corridor was to turn on the television set. Inside the corridor, he located a wall plug, made sure the switch was off, and plugged in the flex. Then he waited. By 1 minute to midnight, the noise above was horrendous. Then suddenly it quietened as somebody roared for silence. In the quiet, Rawlings could hear the television he had switched on in the sitting room. The traditional Scottish programme, with its ballads and Highland dancing, changed to a static image of the clock, mistakenly called Big Ben, atop London's Houses of Parliament. Behind the clock's facade was the giant bell, the real Big Ben. The TV commentator chattered away the seconds to midnight as people across the kingdom charged their glasses. Then the quarters began to sound. After the quarters, there was a pause. Then Big Ben spoke. Bong! The thunderous boom of the first stroke of midnight. It echoed in 20 million homes across the land. It crashed through the apartment on the 9th floor of Fontenoy House and was itself eclipsed by the roar of cheering and auld lang syne. As the first boom rang out on the 8th floor, Jim Rawlings flicked the electric switch to on. The flat crack went unnoticed, save by himself. He waited 60 seconds. Then unplugged his lead and began to work his way back to the safe, tidying up his gear as he went. The plumes of smoke were clearing. Of the plastic cushion and its gallon of water, there was nothing left but a few damp patches. The door of the safe looked as if it had been cleft from top to bottom by a blunt axe wielded by a giant. Rawlings blew away the few plumes of smoke and, with gloved hand, pulled the smaller part of the door back on its hinges. The tinplate box had been torn apart by the blast, but all the bolts in the other section of the door were in their sockets. The part he had opened was large enough for him to peer inside, a cash box and a velvet bag. He eased out the bag, undid the drawstring, and emptied the contents onto the coffee table. They glittered and flared in the light as if they contained their own fire, the Glen diamonds. Rawlings put the remainder of his equipment back in the false champagne bottle, the flex, the empty detonator box, the thumbtacks, and remainder of the CLC, before he realized he had an unforeseen problem. The pendant and earrings would slip into his trouser pockets, but the tiara was wider and higher than he had thought. He glanced round for a receptacle that would attract no attention. It was lying on top of the bureau a few feet away. He emptied the contents of the attaché case into the bowl of an armchair, a collection of wallets, credit cards, pens, address books, and a couple of folders. It was exactly right. The case took all the Glen suite and the champagne bottle, which might have seemed odd if seen leaving a party. With a last glance around the sitting room, Rawlings switched off the light, stepped back into the hall, and closed the door. Once in the corridor, he relocked the main door with a Chubb lock, and 60 seconds later strolled past the porter's lodge and out into the night. The man did not even look up. It was nearly midnight, that first day of January, when Harold Filby sat down at the sitting-room table in his Moscow flat. He had had his bender the previous evening at the Blake's party, but had not even enjoyed it. His thoughts were too locked into what he would have to write. During the morning he had recovered from the inevitable hangover, and now, with Erita and the boys in bed asleep, he had the peace and quiet to try to think things out. There was a coo from across the room. Philby rose and went over to the large cage in the corner and gazed through the bars at a pigeon with one leg in splints. He had always adored pets, from his vixen in Beirut through a range of canaries and parakeets in this very apartment. The pigeon waddled across the floor of its cage, the splinted leg impeding its passage. "All right, old fella," said Philby through the bars. "We'll have them off soon and you can fly again." He returned to the table. It had got to be good, he told himself for the 100th time. The General Secretary was a bad man to cross and a hard one to deceive. Some of those senior Air Force men who had made such a dog's breakfast of the tracking and downing of the Korean jetliner back in 1983 had, on his personal recommendation, ended in cold graves beneath the permafrost of the Kamchatka. Racked by health problems, confined to a wheelchair part of the time, he might be, but he was still the undisputed master of the USSR. His word was law, his brain was still razor-sharp, and his pale eyes missed nothing. Taking paper and pencil, Philby began to rough out the first draft of his reply. 4 hours later, but at the same period, just before midnight in London, the owner of the apartment at Fontenoy House returned alone to the capital. A tall, greying, and distinguished man in his mid-50s, he drove straight into the basement car park using his own plastic admission card and took his own suitcase up in the elevator to the 8th floor. He was in a foul mood. He had driven for 6 hours, having left his brother-in-law's stately home 3 days prematurely, following a blazing row with his wife. She, angular and horsey, adored the countryside as much as he loathed it. Content to stride the bleak Yorkshire moors in midwinter, she had left him miserably cooped up indoors with her brother, the 10th Duke, which was in a way worse, for the apartment owner, who prided himself on his appreciation of the manly virtues, was convinced the wretched fellow was gay. The New Year's Eve dinner had been appalling for him, surrounded as he was by his wife's cronies, who talked hunting, shooting, and fishing the entire time, the whole being punctured by the high, wittering laugh of the Duke and his two handsome pals. That morning he had made some remark to his wife, and she had gone off the deep end. The result was, it had been agreed he could drive south alone after tea. She would remain as long as she wished, which might be a month. He entered the hall of his apartment and paused. The alarm system should be emitting a loud, repeated peep, which should last for 30 seconds before the full alarm sounded, during which time he could reach the master box and turn it off. Damn thing, he thought, probably out of order. He went into the cloak's cupboard and turned the whole system off with his personal key. Then he entered the sitting room and threw on the light. He stood, with his bag behind him in the hall, and stared at the scene in open-mouthed horror. The damp patches had evaporated in the warmth, and the television was not on. What caught his eye at once was the scorched wall and cloven safe door right ahead of him. He crossed the room in several strides and peered into the safe. There was no doubt. The diamonds were gone. He looked around again, saw his possessions scattered in the armchair by the fire, and the carpet lifted from its smooth edge all round the walls. He sank into the other fireside armchair, as white as a sheet. "Oh, my God!" he breathed. He seemed stunned by the nature of the disaster, and remained in the chair for 10 minutes, breathing heavily and staring at the disarray. Finally he rose and went to the telephone. With a trembling forefinger, he dialed a number. At the other end it rang and rang, but there was no reply. The following morning, just before 11, John Preston walked down Curzon Street towards the headquarters of the department he worked for, round the corner from the Mirabelle restaurant, in which few of the department's employees could afford to dine. Most of the civil service that Friday morning were being allowed to bridge over from Thursday, the New Year's Day, which was a public holiday anyway, into the weekend. But Brian Harcourt Smith had asked him to come in especially, so he had come. He suspected he knew what the Deputy Director General of MI5 wanted to talk about. For 3 years, over half the time he had spent with MI5 since joining them as a late entrant in the summer of 1981, John Preston had been in F branch of the service, dealing with surveillance of extreme political organizations, left and right, with research into these bodies and the running of agents within them. For 2 of those years, he had been in F1, heading up D section, concerned with the penetration of extreme left-wing elements into Britain's Labour Party. The result of his investigations, his report, had been submitted 2 weeks earlier, just before Christmas. He was surprised it had been read and digested so quickly. He presented himself at the front desk, proffered his card, was vetted, checked out to the DDG's office as an expected visitor, and allowed to proceed to the top of the building. He was sorry he would not be seeing the Director-General personally. He liked Sir Bernard Hemmings, but it was an open secret inside Five that the old man was ill and spending less and less time in the office. In his absence, the day-to-day running of the department was passing more and more into the hands of his ambitious deputy, a fact which did not please some of the older veterans of the service. Sir Bernard was a Five man from way back and had done his field work. He could establish empathy with the men who went out on the streets, staked out suspects, tailed hostile couriers, and penetrated subversive organizations. Harcourt Smith was of the university intake, with a first-class degree, and had been mainly a head office man, moving smoothly between the departments and steadily up the promotion ladder. He received Preston warmly in his office, immaculately dressed as ever. Preston was wary of the warmth. Others had been received just as warmly, so went the stories, and had been out of service a week later. Harcourt Smith seated Preston in front of his desk, and himself behind it. Preston's report lay on the blotter.
"Now, John, this report of yours. You'll understand, of course, that I take it, along with all your work, extremely seriously."
"Thank you," said Preston.
"So much so," Harcourt Smith went on, "that I spent a good part of the festivities break right here in this office to reread it and consider it."
Preston thought it wiser to remain silent.
"It is, how shall I put it, pretty radical. No holds barred, eh? The question is, and this is the question I have to ask myself before this department proposes any kind of policy based upon it, is it all absolutely true? Can it be verified? This is what I should be asked.
Look, Brian, I spent 2 years on that investigation. My people went deep, very deep. The facts, where I stated them as facts, are true.
Ah, John, I'd never dispute any facts presented by you, but the conclusions drawn from them
are based on logic, I think, said Preston.
A great discipline. I used to study it, resumed Harcourt Smith, but not always supported by hard evidence, wouldn't you agree? Let's take this thing here.
He found the place in the report, and his finger ran along one line.
The MBR. Pretty extreme, wouldn't you say?
Oh, yes, Brian, it's extreme. These are pretty extreme people,
no doubt about it. But wouldn't it have been helpful to have a copy of the MBR attached to your report?
So far as I could discover, it hasn't been written down. It's a series of intentions, albeit very firm intentions, in the minds of certain people.
Harcourt Smith sucked regretfully at a tooth. Intentions, he said, as though the word intrigued him. Yes, intentions. But you see, John, there are a lot of intentions in the minds of a lot of people vis-a-vis this country, not all of them friendly. But we can't propose policy, measures, or countermeasures on the basis of these intentions.
Preston was about to speak, but Harcourt Smith swept on, rising to indicate the interview was over.
Look, John, leave this with me a while longer. I'll have to think on it, and perhaps take a few soundings before I decide where I can best place it. By the way, how do you like F1D?
I like it fine, said Preston, rising also.
I may have something for you that you'll like even more, said Harcourt Smith.
When Preston had gone, Harcourt Smith stared for several minutes at the door through which he had passed. He seemed lost in thought. Simply to shred the file, which he privately regarded as embarrassing and possibly one day dangerous, was not possible. It had been formally presented by a section head. It had a file number. He thought long and hard. Then he took his red ink pen and wrote carefully on the cover of the Preston report. He pressed his buzzer for his secretary. Mabel, he said when she entered, take this down to register yourself, please, right now.
The girl glanced at the cover of the file. Across it were written the letters NFA and Brian Harcourt Smith's initials. In the service, NFA stands for No Further Action. The report was to be buried. Chapter 2. It was not until the 4th of January, the following Sunday, that the apartment owner at Fontenoy House was able to get an answer from the number he had been ringing every hour for 3 days. It was a brief conversation when it took place, but it resulted in his meeting with another man just before the hour of luncheon in a recessed alcove of one of the public rooms in a very discreet West End hotel. The newcomer was about 60, with iron-grey hair, soberly dressed, and with the air of a kind of civil servant, which, in a way, he was. He was the second to arrive, and seated himself with an immediate apology. "I'm terribly sorry I wasn't available these past 3 days," he said. "Being a single man, I was invited by some kind friends to spend the New Year period with them out of town. Now, what seems to be the problem?" The apartment owner told him in short, clear sentences. He had had time to think exactly how he would convey the enormity of what had happened, and he chose his phrases well. The other man considered the narrative with deepening gravity. "You're quite right, of course," he said at length. "It could be very serious. When you returned on Thursday night, did you call the police, or at any time since?" "No, I thought it better to talk to you first." "Ah, a pity in a way. It's too late now, anyway. Their forensic people would establish the blowing of the safe was 3 or 4 days old. Hard to explain that. Unless..."
"Yes?" asked the apartment owner eagerly.
"Unless you could maintain that the mirror was back in its place and everything in such apple-pie order that you could live there for 3 days and not know you had been burgled."
"Hardly," said the apartment owner. "The carpet had been taken up all round the edges. The bastard must have walked around the walls to avoid the pressure pads."
"Yes," mused the other. "They'd hardly credit the burglar so neat he even replaces the carpets as well as the mirror, so that won't work. Nor, I fear, could one pretend you had spent the intervening 3 days somewhere else."
"But where? I would have been seen, but I haven't. Club, hotel, I would have had to check in.
Precisely, said the confidant.
No, it won't work. For better or worse, the die is cast. It's too late to call in the police now. Then what the hell do I do? Asked the apartment owner. They have simply got to be recovered.
How long will your wife remain away from London? Asked the other.
Who knows? She enjoys it up in Yorkshire. Some weeks, I hope.
Then we shall have to effect the replacement of the damaged safe with a new and identical model. Also, a replica set of the Glen Diamonds. It will take time to arrange.
But how about what has been stolen? Asked the apartment owner desperately. They can't just be left somewhere out there on the loose. I've got to have them back.
True, nodded the other. Look, as you may imagine, my people have some contacts in the world of diamonds. I'll cause inquiries to be made.
The gems will almost certainly be passed to one of the main centres for reshaping. They could not be marketed as they are, too identifiable. I'll see if the burglar can be traced and the things recovered.
The man rose and prepared to leave. His friend remained seated, evidently deeply worried. The sober-suited man was equally dismayed, but he hid it better.
Do nothing and say nothing untoward, he advised. Keep your wife in the country as long as possible. Behave perfectly normally.
Rest assured, I shall be in touch. The following morning, John Preston was one of those who joined the great throng of people surging back into central London after the too long 5-day break. As he lived in South Kensington, it suited him to come to work on the Underground. He disembarked at Goodge Street and made his way the remaining 500 yards on foot, an unnoticeable man of medium height and build, aged 46, in a grey raincoat and hatless, despite the chill. Near the top of Gordon Street, he turned into the entrance of an equally unnoticeable building that could have been an office block like any other, solid but not modern, and purporting to house an insurance enterprise. Only inside the hallway were the differences from other office blocks in the neighbourhood discernible. For one thing, there were three men in the lobby, one on the door, one behind the reception desk, and one by the lift doors. All were of a size and muscularity not normally associated with the underwriting of insurance policies. Any stray citizen seeking to do business with this particular company and declining to be directed elsewhere would have learned the hard way that only those presenting an identification that could pass the scrutiny of the small computer terminal beneath the reception desk were permitted beyond the lobby. The British Security Service, better known as MI5, does not live in one single building. Discreetly, but inconveniently, it is split up into four office blocks. The headquarters are in Charles Street, and no longer at the old HQ, Leconfield House, so habitually mentioned in the newspapers. The next biggest block is in Gordon Street, known simply as Gordon, and nothing else, just as the head office is known as Charles. The other two premises are in Cork Street, known as Cork, and a humble annex in Marlborough Street, again known simply by the street name. The department is divided into six branches, scattered throughout the buildings. Again, discreetly but confusingly, some of the branches have sections in different buildings. In order to avoid an inordinate use of shoe leather, all are linked by extremely secure telephone lines, with a flawless system for identification of the credentials of the caller. A branch handles in its various sections policy, technical support, property establishment, registry, data processing, and the office of the legal adviser and the watcher service. The last named is the home of that idiosyncratic group of men and some women of all ages and types, streetwise and ingenious, who can mount the finest personal surveillance teams in the world. Even hostiles have had to concede that on their own ground MI5's watchers are just about unbeatable. Unlike the Secret Intelligence Service, MI6, which handles foreign intelligence and has absorbed a number of Americanisms into its in-house jargon, the Security Service, MI5, covering internal counterintelligence, bases most of its jargon on former police phrases. It avoids terms like surveillance operative and still calls its tracker teams simply the Watchers. B branch handles recruitment, personnel, vetting, promotions, pensions and finance, meaning salaries and operational expenses. C branch concerns itself with the security of the civil service, its staffers and its buildings, the security of contractors, mainly those civilian firms handling defence and communications work, military security, in close liaison with the armed forces' own internal security staffs, and sabotage in reality or prospect. There used to be a D branch, but with the arcane logic known only to its practitioners in the intelligence world, it was long ago renamed K branch. It is one of the biggest, and its biggest section is just called Soviet, being subdivided into operations, field investigations, and order of battle. Next in K comes Soviet satellites, also divided into the same three subsections, then research, and finally agents. As may be imagined, K devotes its not inconsiderable labours to keeping track of the huge number of Soviet and satellite agents who operate, or try to, out of the various embassies, consulates, legations, trade missions, banks, news agencies and commercial enterprises that a lenient British government has allowed to be scattered all over the capital and, in the case of consulates, the provinces. Also, inside K branch, is a modest office inhabited by the officer whose job is to liaise between MI5 and its sister service MI6. This officer is in fact a six man, on secondment to Charles Street in order to carry out his liaison duties. The section is known simply as K7. E branch, the alphabetical sequence resumes with E, covers international communism and its adherents who may wish to visit Britain for nefarious reasons, or the homegrown variety who may wish to go abroad for the same purposes. Also inside E, Far East maintains liaison officers in Hong Kong, New Delhi, Canberra, and Wellington, while All Regions does the same in Washington, Ottawa, the West Indies, and other friendly capitals. Finally, F branch, to which John Preston belonged, at least until that morning, covering political parties, extreme left-wing, political parties, extreme right-wing, research, and agents. F branch lives at Gordon, on the fourth floor, and it was to his office there that John Preston made his way that January morning. He might not have thought his report of 3 weeks earlier would establish him as Brian Harcourt Smith's flavour of the month, but he still believed his report would go to the desk of the Director-General himself, Sir Bernard Hemmings. Hemmings, he was confident, would feel able to impart its information and admittedly part conjectural findings to the Chairman of the Joint Intelligence Committee or the Permanent Under-Secretary at the Home Office, the political ministry commanding MI5. A good PUS would probably feel his minister should glance at it, and the Home Secretary could have drawn the attention of the Prime Minister to it. The memorandum on his desk when he arrived indicated this was not going to happen. After reading the sheet, he sat back, lost in thought. He was prepared to stand by that report, and if it had gone higher, there would have been questions to answer. He could have answered them, would have answered them, for he was convinced he was right. He could have answered them, that is, as head of F1D, but not after being transferred to another department. After a transfer, it would be the new head of F1D who would be the one to raise the issue of the Preston report, and he was satisfied the man appointed to succeed him, almost certain to be one of Harcourt Smith's most loyal protégés, would do no such thing. He made one call to registry. Yes, it had been filed. He noted the registry file number, just for future reference, if any. "What do you mean, NFA?" he asked incredulously. "All right, sorry, yes, I know it's not down to you, Charlie. I was just asking. A bit surprised, that's all." He replaced the receiver and sat back, thinking deeply. Thoughts a man should not think about his superior officer, even if there was no personal empathy between them. But the thoughts would not go away. It was possible, he conceded, that if his report had gone higher, its general burden might eventually have been imparted to Neil Kinnock, leader of the Labour Party opposition in Parliament, who might not have been best pleased. It was also possible that at the next election, due within 17 months at the outside, Labour could win, and that Brian Harcourt Smith was entertaining the hope that one of the new government's first acts would be to confirm him as Director-General of MI5. Not offending powerful politicians in office, or who might come to office, was nothing new. For a man of weak and tremulous disposition, or of vaulting ambition, refusal to impart the bad news could be a powerful motive for inertia. Everyone in the service recalled the affair of a former Director-General, Sir Roger Hollis. Even to this day the mystery had never been completely solved, though partisans on both sides had their convinced opinions.
Back in 1962 and 1963, Roger Hollis had known, almost from the outset of the business, the full details of the Christine Keeler affair, as it came to be known. He had had on his desk, weeks if not months before the scandal blew open, reports of the Cliveden parties, of Stephen Ward, who provided the girls, and who was in any case reporting back, of Soviet attaché Ivanov, sharing the favours of the same girl as Britain's own war minister. Yet he had sat back as the evidence mounted, and never sought, as was his duty, a personal meeting with his own Prime Minister, Harold Macmillan. Without that warning, Macmillan had walked into the scandal, leading with his jaw. The affair had festered and suppurated through the summer of 1963, hurting Britain at home and abroad, for all the world as if it had been scripted in Moscow. Years later, the argument still raged. Had Roger Hollis been a supine incompetent, or had he been much, much worse? "Bollocks," said Preston to himself, and banished his thoughts. He reread the memorandum again. It was from the head of B4, promotions, personally, and advised him that he was, as of that day, transferred and promoted to head of C1A. The tone was in the cosy friendliness that is supposed to soften the blow. "I am advised by the DDG that it would be so helpful if the new year could begin with all fresh postings occupied. Most grateful if you could tidy up any outstanding things and hand over to young Maxwell without too much delay, even within a couple of days, if possible. My warmest best wishes for your satisfaction with the new post." Blah, 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 thought Preston. C1, he knew, was civil service personnel and buildings, and A section meant within the capital. He was to be in charge of security in all Her Majesty's ministries in London. "It's a bloody policeman's job," he snorted, and began to call up his team to say goodbye. A mile away, across London, Jim Rawlings opened the door of a small but exclusive jewellery shop in a side road not 200 yards from the surging traffic of Bond Street. The shop was dark, but its discreet lights fell on showcases containing Georgian silver, and in the illuminated counter-display areas could be seen jewellery of a bygone era. Evidently the emporium specialised in antique pieces rather than their modern counterparts. He was wearing a neat dark suit, silk shirt and muted tie, and carried a dully gleaming attaché case. The girl behind the counter looked up and took him in with a glance of appreciation. At 36 he looked lean and fit, with an aura that was part gentleman, part tough. Always a useful combination. She pushed out her chest and flashed a bright smile. "Can I help you?" "I'd like to see Mr. Zablonsky. Personal." His Cockney accent indicated he was unlikely to be a customer. Her face fell. "You a rep?" she asked. "Just say Mr. James would like to speak to him," said Rawlings. But at that moment the mirrored door at the rear of the shop opened, and Louis Zablonsky came out. He was a short, wizened man of 56, but looked older. "Mr. James," he beamed. "How nice to see you. Please come into my office. How have you been keeping?" He ushered Rawlings through the counter and into his inner sanctum. "That's all right, Sandra, my dear." Inside his small and cluttered office, he closed and locked the mirrored door, through which a view of the outer shop could be seen. He gestured Rawlings to the chair in front of his antique desk and took the swivel chair behind it. A single spotlight beamed down on the blotter. He eyed Rawlings keenly.
"Well now, Jim, what have you been up to?"
"Got something for you, Louis. Something you'll like. So don't tell me it's rubbish." Rawlings flicked open his attaché case. Zablonsky spread his hands.
"Jim, would I..."
His words were cut off as he saw what Rawlings was placing on the blotter. When they were all there, he stared at them in disbelief.
"The Glen Suite," he breathed. "You've gone and nicked the Glen diamonds. It's not even been in the papers yet."
"So, maybe they're still far away from London," said Rawlings. "There was no alarm raised. I'm good. You know that."
"The best, Jim, the best. But the Glen Suite. Why didn't you tell me?"
Rawlings knew it would have been easier for all if a route for the Glen Suite had been set up before the robbery, but he worked in his own way, which was extremely carefully.
He trusted no one, least of all a fence, even a blue-chip top-of-the-market fence like Louis Oblonsky. A fence, hit by a police raid and facing a long stretch of porridge, would be quite able to trade information on a coming heist against a let-off for himself. The serious crime squad down at Scotland Yard knew about Zablonsky, even if he had never seen the inside of one of HM prisons. That was why Rawlings never pre-announced one of his jobs and always arrived unheralded. So he did not answer. Zablonsky, in any case, was lost in contemplation of the jewels that sparkled on his blotter. He, too, knew their provenance without being told. Inheriting the suite in 1936, the 9th Duke of Sheffield had had two offspring, a boy and a girl, Lady Fiona Glen. When he in turn died in 1980, he bequeathed them not to his son, the heir to the title, but to his daughter. The saddened Duke had been forced to realize by 1974, when his son was 25, that the exotic young man was what gossip columnists are pleased to call one of nature's bachelors. There would be no more pretty young countesses of Margate or duchesses of Sheffield to wear the famed Glen diamonds. So they had gone to the daughter. Zablonsky knew that after the Duke's death, Lady Fiona had taken to wearing them occasionally, with the insurer's grudging permission, usually for charity galas at which she was a not infrequent presence. The rest of the time they lay where they had spent so many years, in darkness, in the vaults of Coutts on Park Lane. He smiled. "The charity gala at Grosvenor House just before the new year?" he asked. Rawlings shrugged. "Oh, you're a naughty boy, Jim, but such a talented one." Although he spoke fluent Polish, Yiddish, and Hebrew, Louis Oblonsky, after 40 years in Britain, had never quite mastered English, which he spoke with a discernible Polish accent. He also, because he had learned them from books written years earlier, mistakenly used phrases that nowadays could be regarded as camp. Rawlings knew there was nothing gay about Louis Oblonsky. In fact, Rawlings knew, because Beryl Oblonsky had told him, that the old man had been neutered in one of the concentration camps as a boy. Oblonsky was still admiring the diamonds, as a true connoisseur will admire any masterpiece. He recalled vaguely having read somewhere that in the mid-60s Lady Fiona Glen had married a rising young civil servant, who by the mid-80s had become a senior mandarin in one of the ministries, and that the couple lived somewhere in the West End at a most elegant and luxurious standard maintained largely by the wife's private fortune. "So what do you think, Louis?"
"I'm impressed, my dear Jim, very impressed, but also perplexed. These are not just ordinary stones. These are identifiable anywhere in the diamond world. What am I to do with them?"
"So you tell me," said Rawlings. Louis Oblonsky spread his hands wide.
"I will not lie to you, Jim. I will tell you straight. The Glen Diamonds probably have an insured value of £750,000, which is roughly what they would fetch if sold legitimately on the open market by Cartier. But they can't be sold like that, obviously. That leaves two options. One is to find a very rich buyer who would want to buy the famous Glen Diamonds, knowing he could never display them or admit ownership, a rich miser content to gloat over them in privacy. There are such people, but very few. From such a person one could get perhaps half the price I have named."
"When could you find a buyer like that?"
Zablonsky shrugged. "This year, next year, sometime, never. You can't just advertise in the personal columns."
"Too long," said Rawlings. "The other way?"
"Prize them out of their settings. That act alone would reduce the value to £600,000. Repolish them and sell them separately as four unmatched individual gems. One might get £300,000, but the repolisher would want his cut. If I carried those costs personally, I think I could let you have £100,000. But at the end of the day, after the sales had been completed..."
"So what can you let me have up front? I can't live in fresh air, Louis."
"Who can?" said the old fence. "Look, for the white gold setting, I can get maybe £2,000 on the scrap market. For the 40 small stones put through the legitimate market, say £12,000. That's £14,000, which I can recover quickly. I can let you have half up front in cash now. What do you say?"
They talked for another 30 minutes and clinched their deal. From his safe, Louis Oblonsky took £7,000 in cash.
Rawlings opened the attaché case and laid the wads of used notes inside.
Nice, said Zablonsky.